It wasn't the intent 5 years ago. We had different ideas of what it was going to be.
What was the intent? More often than not, foil drive is used as like the generic term to say foil assist. Does that bother you at all?
We are foilers at heart. We love foiling. We just want to make foiling better. The way we see it is better anyway, and more accessible, and produce something that makes it more fun.
The thing that you actually wanted to surf more waves, and it seems like right now you cannot do that. And the question is your plan on like handing off certain parts of the company so that you actually can get back on the water more?
This episode is sponsored by Foil Sessions, the foiling app that lets you track all your foiling sports. This is a This episode is also supported by Surfears, but more on that later.
Welcome to episode 67 of Up on Foil, the podcast where we talk all about foiling. And today I'm honored to have Paul Martin with me here. And let me introduce us real quick. Me, I'm Matt. I'm an average foiler, have a little YouTube channel and used Foil Drive this year quite a lot, actually, yep, compared to other people in Switzerland. And with me is Paul, and you are Mr. Foil Drive. And first and foremost, I want to thank you very much for inventing that product and bringing it to market, because it helped me a lot in my downwind journey. Yeah. And you just said that you came out of a four-hour meeting, and I just want to get right into the business side, man. How often are you actually on the water still, testing things, doing stuff fun? How much is it just like administration and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think that's a misunderstood thing. Not on the water as much as I'd like to be. Unfortunately, it's probably down to maybe one or two times a month at the moment, which is not enough. So we're building the team behind the works to try and get more people into more roles so that, you know, I can try and get back in the water a bit more. But it's a pretty big operation now. Global business, and it's 47 staff now, something like that, last time I checked. So there's a lot of people, a lot of mouths to feed, and just the big operations. Yeah, it's a lot of meetings, computer work, Zoom calls, organizing things, designing stuff, which is my primary role. But yeah, it's pretty relentless. Turns out the world likes foil drives, so they're extra busy. It wasn't the intent 5 years ago. We had different ideas of what it was going
to
be.
What was the intent? Was it just to build a product for yourself and maybe share it with some friends?
I suppose in a simplistic way, kind of, but my inner business self was, you know, it was never going to be that. It was more a question of, we didn't really know how quickly it would grow, as I suppose is the... well, look, I knew it would grow. I knew it was going to be a good product. I knew it had the right DNA to be a good product. It just grew a little faster than anticipated. Luckily, we were able to capture that and grow with it. But it does mean that it's turned into a much bigger job role and contact time than most people would think.
I want to get like two parts of your story today. One is you as a foiler or water sports enthusiast, and then the business side as well. And how important was it that you teamed up with Ben Jameson to have a good partner to start with?
That's critical. I mean, a business really is just a collection of people all operating towards a common goal. If the people that you're involved with aren't, you know, passionate about the common goal, then you probably got a, you know, pretty average business. And look, he used to work with me in my first company, which was a drone company, not the sort of toy ones, the more serious commercial stuff. but yeah, I always recognized in Ben that he had the entrepreneurial spirit and the ability to tough it out, which is really important when you're starting a company from scratch, and just needed a good idea to latch his teeth into and get on with it. So that was great. He was working for me at the time, and that company was sold off and finished. When I sold that company off, I was like, well, I've got another idea, and do you want to join? And he was stoked to have something to work with me on. And we've been friends and business partner ever since. Friends for longer, business partner in the last 5 years. But no, it's a massive team effort. Like, I'll probably end up on videos and podcasts a lot more than I technically should relative to the amount of people that work in the company, but that's pretty common. Like, I follow Elon Musk pretty intently, and you know, he gets a lot of the accolades and spends most of the time on the big screen, but he has an army of people working behind the scenes to make his dreams come to reality. But you do still need that key individual that has the design and the idea and the conviction that it's the right thing and is willing to press go on it, and then get a team of people to follow him or her to that end goal. So that's still important. Without that, you know, like, everyone's just walking around in a paddock lost, really. So yeah, it's a team effort, but you still need to have, I suppose, a worthy idea and approach to follow, which hopefully I can provide.
Talking about the team, you said that you grew like to a really big team now. I think if you grow, it's much more difficult to find people who are as enthusiastic as you are. Has that been a problem, or do you even know all the team because it's scattered all over the world?
This year I finally got to meet everyone. There was a period of time there where there was quite a few people that that worked for me that I hadn't had a chance to meet in person, which is always a bit of a shame, but when they're scattered all over the planet, it's a little tricky. There's a few members in Europe that still have yet to do a face-to-face catch up, which is a bit of a shame, but I'll get there over there next year. But with all the events that we've got on around the world, and we try to go to what we can, especially the big ones, that's a good place to catch up with the overseas team. Finding common people, that can be tricky, but we've been really lucky with the friendships that we've had in the past with others that have sort of joined, like Dominic Hoskins, and he was actually a customer. He was actually the first customer on the website. And we stayed in touch, and he was a foiling mad, loves everything foiling, and loved Foil Drive, and, you know, stayed in touch, and eventually ended up working for Foil Drive and is now the director of Foil Drive Europe. So, you know, we've got a lot of really cool people that have joined along the way. It seems to be a fun company to work for, and we build cool things. So I could think of worse jobs.
Yeah, I saw that, or I talked to Dominic obviously already, and it's been on your movie on YouTube, The First Wave, where you had that order. It's an amazing film, super cool. Who comes up with, like, we have to do a film about like our first product or about ourselves? Is that also you that do that, or is that some people in marketing who decide we need to have more content on?
That's the marketing team. You're talking about The First Wave, part one of the documentary of where Foil Drive came from. No, that wasn't my idea. That was, I think, the marketing team and a few others within that thought it would be cool to put something together that the general public might find interesting. And it really came about by the amount of people that would come and visit Foil Drive HQ, customers from all over the world. Every time they'd come here, they're like, "Oh, we're out. Like, this is a much bigger operation than we thought. We didn't realize you actually make the foil drives in-house. Like, there's an entire manufacturing facility out the back that we physically make them here." They didn't realize that. So, and then, I don't know, numerous people thought it was an interesting storyline of where it all came from. So they thought, let's put a documentary together. I didn't actually have much to do with it other than sat in front of the camera a bunch of times, and they pinched video footage from over the years. So I got to see it for the first time, it's first airing at AWSI this year at a private viewing for the people from the show. And it was really cool. I loved it. It was great. I thought it was really good.
I think so too. Really cool. I watched it like three times, like in preparation for today. And then I was like, well, people can just watch that and don't have to listen to that podcast. But then I wanted to go further and ask some more questions. So I still think it's kind of relevant. When we look back at, I mean, it's really not long ago, from Gen 1 to Gen 2, that seemed like a huge step. And also for me, it brought it on the map, because the first one, as it said in the video, it looks like a prototype-ish kind of thing. even though it wasn't, it was a product that you sold, obviously. How important was that for you? Was that like in the back of your head from the beginning that you wanted to do something like that?
Well, the design principle and like the actual package of Gen 2 was what I originally actually wanted to make.
Yeah.
But I knew enough about manufacturing. Well, I thought I did back then. I knew enough to know that to get to that level was going to require millions of dollars, a lot of R&D, just a lot of knowledge of where to manufacture, how to get it done, how to import, how to export, how to get things certified, how to package things, how to store things, how to ship things, how to, you know, there's so many things that go into making a product. It was too much to start there, way too much. We had to find a team. We had to build a team. We had to get a facility. We had to have a factory. We had to have stockists. We had to have dealers. We had to have team writers. We had to have accountants, manufacturing crew, HR department, advertising, marketing, sales. Like, it just goes on and on and on and on and on. You have to have all those things if you want to be able to sell something like the Gen 2, but you can't just get there overnight. Can't just click your fingers. You can if you're a pre-established company with lots of other product line. Technically, you could. We did still have to have the idea, then you'd have to execute on it. So the original Assist and then the Assist Plus was more of a MVP, which is a minimal viable product, is a term that's used in manufacturing, which is, as it says, it's like the smallest thing that you can make in the minimum amount of quantity that it's still worth making that you can make a profit from and get to the next level. That's the whole concept of MVP. If you look at Tesla, like their first MVP was realistically a gutted Lotus with some of their tech and some other tech, and they cobbled it together to make the first Roadster. It never sold in massive quantities, and it was the beginning of the beginning, and then they went from there. So, and their next product from there was a Model S, which is pretty amazing car. Like, talk about big jump from, you know, a rebadged, re-engineered Lotus to a Model S. So they had to do the same thing. We didn't expect the Assist and the Assist Plus to be sold in the thousands and thousands. So it was an MVP that had a slightly longer lifespan than it probably should have. But as ugly as it looks, it does what it says on the tin, gets you on foil and it sort of unlocks the whole Assist process. And it was the first foil Assist ever made. So, Gen 2 was always what I'd intended, but it was way too much to take on for stage one. Plus, we had to invent the category. It didn't exist.
Yeah.
Did you know that spending time in cold water and wind can cause your ears to slowly grow extra bone, sometimes enough to block them completely? It's called surfer's ear or exostosis, and it's part of your body's natural protective response. But ear problems aren't only about cold. Warm or polluted water can also lead to swimmer's ear, infection and inflammation, whether in pools, lakes, or the ocean. Surfears is the original patented earplug from Sweden. It's modular, customizable, and comfortable, designed to seal from water while keeping hearing and balance intact. Sustainably made and trusted by water people worldwide.
So
that's something super important as well, because I first heard about Foil Drive, and I actually heard it on the podcast when I still was doing it with Gael Daniele, and Dominic Hoskins was on here, and I wasn't sure why I would need Foil Drive, and then he explained it and I tried it and I was like, all right, it makes sense now. But you have to people to get to know it.
Yeah, it's been interesting over the 5 years of doing this. The amount of times I've seen someone that assumes they don't need it, and then it dawns on them, I think, later on, that's the wrong question. It's not a question of do you need it. It's what does it do? What does it unlock, and what can it provide is really the question. Do you technically need a motor car to go from home to work? No. Technically, you could walk or you could ride a bike, but a motor vehicle is quicker, faster, easier. So it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of what. So I think for me, like, the Foil Drive is, what does it provide? What does it unlock? What does it do is the main thing. So for me, when I came to creating it, was like, I want to ride waves. I want to ride more waves. I want it to be easier. I don't want to have to cherry pick the weather window and have the perfect wave and the perfect wind and the perfect tide and I don't want to have to compete with other people for the same takeoff zone. Like, there was a lot of things I didn't want, and there was a lot of things I do wanted, and it was very obvious to me that that was not within my human capabilities to do that. So I was like, well, I need to augment the foil. I need to put a motor system on it. But again, it was, I want autonomous. I want to be able to take off when I want to. I want to ride a smaller board. I want to ride different wings that I can't ride now. And I want to ride in locations I can't get to. And the list went on and on and on. The what was, well, what am I going to do about that? Because I can't do it now. I need to make a hybrid system. But then again, the what was, what do I want out of it? I want a foil. I just want to have a normal foil, normal mast, and not have a big, clunky, heavy e-foil type thing. So that's where the whole assist thing came from was, well, I need power, but I want it to go away. It needs to be small and lightweight, but still powerful enough that it can unlock smaller boards, smaller wings. So that's where foil drive came from. So yeah, I've seen it countless times. People are like, oh, I don't need that. I can paddle up. I'm strong. I'm fit and whatever. Nothing against that. Anyone can do it, respect. But then they go and use it and they're like, oh, wait a minute. It's not a case of I needed foil drive. It's a case of, well, actually now I don't have to ride an 8-foot sup or a long board to downwind. I can downwind a prone board. And I can motor back up wind. Like, just two things. It doesn't matter how fit you are or how amazing you are. You can't upwind downwinder without a motor. I mean,
that's true. That's
extremely true. Fit people might be able to pump up wind a few hundred meters or whatever.
Yeah, but yeah.
With, you know, within reason. Like, and I haven't seen many people, paddle into waves on a downwinder on a 4-foot, 30-liter prone board on a tiny little surf wing. Doesn't work.
That's true.
You know, so, yeah, it's not a matter. Yeah, I don't know if I've answered that well enough, but it's like it just unlocks a different part of the sport. It allows you to do different things. It certainly allows you to ride different wings and boards that I think a lot of people will just never get access to. Mm. And I know that's true because I'm living proof of it, but also the thousands and thousands and thousands of customers that have sent in feedback all saying the same thing can't be wrong. It's a common thing. So. Yeah, I mean, I think it does what it was intended to do, which is extract more fun.
Yeah, definitely. I was in vacation in Italy, and usually I'm a dock starter and doing a little parawinging, winging sometimes, and there was just not enough wind for winging or parawinging. There was no dock. There was one rock, but I can only start a huge foil from it. And really with foil drive and a 20-liter board, I went out pumping, and as soon as there were little waves, I was able to surf them. Was really cool.
The slim or the matte?
Both, but I really love the slim because it's also, for me, it's a family friendly setup because after 20-25 minutes I have to come back in to change the battery and then I can spend a little time with the kids and then can go back later. So if not I would stay out for too long.
Yeah. Well, the slim was we nearly didn't release it. It was.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah, thank you, though.
There was going to be a period where we were just going to do the max. And again, it's like if we had just did the max, then we'd only have to have one voltage architecture. We had the two different batteries. It was the one product. People wouldn't have to make a choice. And there was a lot of discussion within the team. Do we do it? Do we just release the max and then 6 months later release the slim? And in the end, I was like, I think we really need to release both. I think they speak differently to different people, and that at least give you an option. There's no secret the max outsells the slim considerably, but for the people that do buy the slim, they know why they buy it. They want the most nimble, lightest, you know, unobtrusive thing they can get, and they're more about trying to be as close as they could to the natural way of doing it as possible. And they appreciate the reduction in weight and size. And anyone that's ridden the max and then has gone ridden the slim, like, wow, you can barely even feel it's there. But that was like, I also wanted to just set the benchmark and say, no one's beating the slim. No one's going to make something smaller, lighter, as powerful as that. Like, that's it. And, you know, it'll get better over time as we improve it. But I also wanted to just set like, that is as far as it goes within reason. That's still practical. Sure, I could make something that's technically smaller, but it's like there's certain levels of practicality.
Yeah.
But it certainly fits the box for a lot of people that like using it, and then but it turns out there's a lot more people that like the Max, which is fine.
I think if you have a trench board and then you don't have the problem of drag, then maybe the Max could be used, or from my use could be used as well. But now I even tested the Max compared to the Slim, and I went out as far as I could, as I felt comfortable. Like, all right, I don't have much battery left, let's go back. And I use just 2% to get back home. So It's really, if I do a downwinder, you don't need battery really. No. And if you fall twice or three times, it's really not a problem. The Slim is enough.
I mean, it depends on who the user is and what they want.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter at the end of the day. Like, there's plenty of downwinders where I'll come in and I've still got 70% battery. I didn't really need the Max, but I just couldn't be bothered running out of juice 2 kilometers offshore, the wind dies. Like, I've been on a downwinder where it was just endless weed. Oof, we don't know why. It was just tape weed after tape weed after tape weed. And I used the entire battery. I think I must have done 20 starts. Like, it was just relentless. It just kept getting wrapped around the wing. And I was pretty glad that day I had the Max, because I only just, and I mean just, got in. So, yeah. Safety first for me. I'm not
that, it makes a lot of sense.
Not that extreme a rider that I worry about it too much.
When I was in the Netherlands with Dominic, we did a downwinder on the Markermeer, and there were beautiful waves. And then we missed the entrance to the harbor, and we have to motor back like 10 minutes against like 20 knots of wind. And then we were happy that we had the Max as well, just because that was so much battery that was draining. But it was enough still. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I think we've been getting some reports back even super early on. I've only just released in the Fusion. There's a lot of crew that are doing mega upwind, downwind runs on the Fusions.
Really?
I think Josh Koo did 16.5 kilometers upwind the other day, turn around and then downwinded all the way home. It was like a 30, like a 32 plus kilometer solo upwind, downwind mission. No cars, no shuttles, no organization, nothing. Launch at the beach, retrieve at the same beach. And he was just like, this is sick, you know.
That's super cool.
Because anyone that's done downwinders knows that logistically they're crazy.
Yeah,
you spend definitely more time driving around trying to organize and put places than you do riding waves by a factor of 3 or 4.
Yeah, really? Yeah. That's crazy. Luckily in Switzerland, we have trains we can take, but foil drive is not allowed yet. So that would be something that would work. Listen, you said that feedback from customers is important. And I have a question, because more often than not, foil drive is used as like the generic term to say foil assist. Does that bother you at all? Or are you like kind of happy with that?
Are you saying that people keep using the word foil assist?
No, use foil drive. They say foil drive, but they have another foil assist product.
No, not really. I think it just goes to show that foil drive is the most prevalent system on the planet by a big, big, big margin. So it kind of happens. We were talking about that the other day. In Australia, we put beers and drinks in an insulated box, and it's called an esky. And everything was called an esky, but that was just the first company that made in high volume insulated boxes for drinks and beers. But you could buy a different brand. It might be called an Ingle or something like that. People will still call it an esky, even though it's not called an esky, because it's just synonymous with that's what it was. So if anything, it's a badge of honor that people still use it. Like, we've found that there are people that refer to certain breaks and beaches as foil drive beaches, or foil drive break zones, or foil drive waves, or foil drive locations. Like, this isn't stuff that we've put together. This is stuff that we see on the internet. People were referring to, like, these are really good foil drive waves. That's kind of cool. I think it's fun. I don't worry about it too much.
I think that there might be a little problem as well coming with that. As you get bigger and bigger and like take a huge market share, there's always the danger that you or foil drive becomes like the big player that's not too, like, people don't like it too much because it's too big, and they like the smaller, the niche small companies. Are you scared of getting too big?
Not really. I don't think we're going to be I'm trying to think of an example of that that resonates with what we're doing. I think the reason I'm not worried about that is, as a company and as the people that own the company, we are foilers at heart. We love foiling. We just want to make foiling better, the way we see it is better anyway, and more accessible, and produce something that makes it more fun. So our defense against that is we're always going to prioritize the product and the support that we give to our customers, and the fit and finish and the functionality of how it works and what it's supposed to do. That's the primary goal. Whereas a lot of other companies will get lost in trying to make something purely for the sake of profit and having something to sell in that market space. And if you skimp too much on that, or you deviate too far away from that core purpose of what product is, that's where I believe most people go wrong. So we will only get bigger and continue to grow if we continue to execute well. Ooh, my screen went dull then. Why is it gone? There we go.
Back.
We'll only continue to get bigger and dominate the market if we keep doing what we've been doing today, which is build the best product we possibly can for the purpose of giving the end user as much enjoyment as they possibly can. And as long as we don't stray from that, I think the end result is inevitable. You end up with that outcome. So I don't worry about that at all. And good. We're not going to change the mix of how we do it. You know, we would have spent a lot of money on warranty and support and giving people new gear and replacing stuff and replacing heaps of stuff that's well out of its warranty period. We go above and beyond wherever we can on that front because we know people care and people respect that, and they keep coming back because I feel like they're actually looked after. If our sole purpose was just to make the highest profit margin, we wouldn't be doing those things, like straight up. But that's not our goal. The goal has always been just make the best thing you possibly can. And if it's really, really good and lots of people love it, then lots of people will buy it, and the whole financial side of things takes care of itself. I think good. That's been done by a few people globally in certain companies very, really, really well. Again, I come back to Elon Musk. Like, he basically dominates space. He does like 95% of the total mass to orbit, I think it is. If his sole purpose was to just gouge as much money out of the space industry, he would charge an absolute arm and leg for the services that he provides, because people don't have a choice. But he doesn't. He actually offers even more cost-effective, better service. Even though he has the industry by the balls, he could charge whatever he likes because his competitors are nowhere near what they can do, not even close. But he continues on with the intent of what that program was, which is make space more affordable and more obtainable. And he keeps pushing that line of thinking. So, and he's successful because of that, not because of the conventional way of doing it. So I think that's how I see it. And, you know, so far so good. We're going to keep doing that. And we got a lot of really cool stuff that we want to do that improves the use of the goods and makes older stuff newer again, revitalize bits and pieces, expand our servicing and support. Some cool things coming up with what we're going to do for the global customer base to be able to use their 4-wheel drives all over the planet.
Very nice.
That'll be cool.
Very nice. And it's a super complicated product. In the video you put up, the first wave video, I think Ben talked about how many parts go into foil drive. I don't remember the number, but it's so difficult because when I used the Slim with my pump foil board, the connection didn't go through from the remote to the pot. And then I had to get the antenna, but then the screws have to be a little longer. If you'd known how much and how much more things that you need to change a little thing, would you have like done it differently, like try to simplify somehow? I mean, if the screws are a little longer, who cares? Or are you like someone who is super specific and wants like the absolute best, and not only the best is good enough?
Well, I mean, that's why I was late to start the podcast. I was in a 4-hour meeting with multiple other people trying to organize how much stuff we need to order before the end of the year, because there's, you know, Chinese New Year's rolling through and a lot of those factories shut down, and you got to order everything in advance. And then we release new products and they sell in different ratios and different volumes. And now we've got our 3PLs setting up in them, you know, overseas, and it's just logistics is massive. Now, I don't normally get involved with that, but I had to get involved with that because there's some minutiae and there's some detail that they don't know about of future stuff that I'm going to do and how it affects this. And it's, yeah, it's insane. I don't know how many parts we have, how many SKUs we have, but it's ridiculous. And a big part of that is because our system is retrofittable to anything. I remind people throughout the year numerous times, when you're buying a fixed product, let's call it an e-foil, they just make the board, wing, the mast, the battery, and it comes as one thing. And they can work on just that one thing, and they only have to consider that one thing. It's actually much more difficult to make something that is truly retrofittable to anything, or 99%, let's say. All the things you have to consider, like you would be shocked at how many different base plate spacing variances there are. The depth of tracks in all sorts of different boards are different. There's no such thing as a consistent track system. Then there's no such thing as the same length and depth and width and the tolerances. And then you've got M6, M7, and M8 poles. And then you've got different, it's just crazy. But like, we've put so much effort into trying to make sure it can fit everything and anything for everyone. And we're certainly geared up for that, but it doesn't come without a lot of pain and suffering along the way for us to stock all that stuff and have all that supplied. The logistics behind it is scary. Adding a patch antenna option underneath a Gen 2 unit or Gen 2.5, because there's patches for those, you know, people wouldn't believe the amount of money we spent developing a truly passive radio frequency link between a Gen 2, and we had to make it truly passive with no batteries, no power, no nothing. The antenna system had to be funded by the box. The box is the only thing that can transmit. It has to go into that, has to redistribute that signal somewhere else. It has to be fully waterproof. It has to be totally passively linked and coupled. And it's got to work through carbon and water as mission. I mean, we could have done it cheaper and easier, but I said, no, it's got to be good. It's got to be absolutely rock solid. This thing should be able to transmit and work through anything. And so we did that. But it did require some people have a box that's the deep box, and then they want to put a patch antenna, and then they want to put a Gen 2 or something on there.
Yeah.
We worked out that some people need bolts that are slightly longer again. So we go away and we manufacture all new bolts just at that length, just for those people. And we've got thousands and thousands of them sitting on the shelf, and we'll probably never sell them all.
Okay. But if we didn't care. I just got longer shoes, though. So for me, that works. Thank you very much for that. Yeah. when I watched that documentary, I saw that on the PMD motor pot, like your first edition,
yep,
you used the same screws back then as they're used right now, which I think was super cool.
Yeah.
That obviously worked. But when you look back at some of the early stuff, or even the current one, do you have some things where you see like, all right, well, it's the way it is now, but we should have done it differently?
Yep. Definitely. Definitely. I wish I had never used M3 bolts that were fully threaded for the props, because we snapped a lot of those back in the day. We eventually ended up resolving that by having to machine custom-made stainless 316 custom bolts that are fully shanked all the way through with a little shoulder and the proper head and the right thread depth, and they're way stronger, and no one's ever broken a single bolt since.
All right.
I probably wouldn't have used M3 for anything. I probably would have gone straight to M4. The puck shape, I wish I never made it like that. I would have done something differently. What else? Would have never used certain plugs in the very early assist days. I wish I had a crystal ball. I just don't.
Yeah.
But you start with these things, and the next minute, you know, you've made 100 of them, and then you blink, and then it's like 1,000 of them out there. And you're like, oh, shit. We probably should have done this, but if we now change it now, then everyone in the past is then locked out. And so it's an imperfect balance of never-ending compromises.
Okay, but you can live with that? Or you had to learn to live with that?
Well, I mean, as long as if it's totally not working and it's an absolute disaster, then sure, you have to go back and fix it. And we've had a few of those, like propeller bolts. We have to change those. And we offered, you know, replacements, and we sent them out for free and all that sort of stuff. And the latches, and latches are a weird one. Like, there were so many people that had never broken a latch, and they're still on their original latch to this day. Like, Rob Piros has probably done the most foil driving of anyone on planet Earth, and I could say that comfortably. He's on his original Gen 2 box and in his original latches, and he's done 3,000 man hours of foiling on that.
Wow.
Yeah. That guy foils every single day, twice a day, with exceptions of horrific weather or whatever. But my point is, we went through this phase of latches were snapping left, right, and center, but then you'd have all these other people that, oh, my latches are fine. I've never broken one. And it's when you're making injection molded parts, it's basically lots and lots of pellets all getting melted and squished into these big molds. And it depends on how the pellets are mixed. It depends on how quickly you squirt it in there. It depends on how quickly you cool those parts. It depends on how quickly you open the tool, how fast you shoot them, how slow you cool them. There's so many different things, and you go and you make a bag of 10,000 of these things at a time, they all look the same. It's like, when's the last time you tried to do a destructive test on two different carbon fiber masts? I guarantee you they both snap at exactly the same rate, number. They might have the same product name, but they're not identical. So, we had batches of latches that were snapping, and in the end we figured out why, and we had to change the material and the way it was done, and I've never seen one of the new latches break since. Not a single one. So, you know, manufacturing's hard. It's really freaking hard.
I can imagine.
It's even worse when it's electronic and you put it in your seat. Yeah,
like the salt water. But hey, listen, I want to talk about something else that for me is super important as well. I don't know if it's important for you as well. It comes out of your brain, because when I first got the foil drive kit, I think the way it is presented in that box, everything has its place. That's so important as well. Was that important for you as well, or was that someone for marketing saying that, you know, we need to have a premium product and the packaging needs to be premium as well?
I actually wanted to do it. I wanted to lay it out like that. Actually, what I did is I got most of the components, put it in CAD, and drew lines around it, and sort of worked out what we sort of needed. And then other people within the team got involved, and we sort of massaged a few things and bits and pieces. But yeah, the first Gen 2 packaging is kind of a weird one. A lot of people love it. And then we've had some people saying, well, once I've unpacked it, the box is useless to me. I want a different type of case. I'm like, yeah, okay. You can never please everyone. But yeah, I thought the packaging was good. I've had a lot of feedback to say it was. Even like all the little bolts just lined up in a straight line. I don't know. I like that bit. But the new Fusion is different. The case doesn't have like this fixed foam cutout. And that's it. It's got a foam cutout at the top to hold the Fusion unit and the controller. But then when you pull that out, all your other components are sort of underneath there in separate boxes. But once you pull them out and you throw all that packaging away, you kind of get left with this case that you can put all sorts of things in the bottom, but still have your unit and controller neatly placed and put it back in. And then the straps that go over the top of the Fusion box are really long for good reason. You can stuff some wings and some batteries in their case underneath it, and you can grab it with one handle and sort of walk off it. So it's trying to be more functional this time around, as in like continue to use the packaging. But I'm glad you like the original packaging. There's a tick there, so that's good.
Now it seems like you're, and as you said, you just come out of a 4-hour meeting. It seems more like painting the big picture and organizing stuff. How much do you miss the days when you were actually working on a prototype thing? Or does that still happen just for future products?
No, it still happens. I'm heavily involved in developing the next thing and trying to figure it out. That literally falls on my shoulders. I probably have a bigger team around me now to help put bits together to go and test, but I still do a fair bit of that. Not as much as I would like. Half my week gets chewed up with other things. But, you know, we're hiring more and more people to try and fill those gaps so I can get back to the really important thing, which is developing product. So that's what I much prefer to do. And being in the water would be nice. But
that's what I wanted to transition into. The thing that you actually wanted to surf more waves. And it seems like right now you cannot do that. And the question is your plan on like handing off certain parts of the company so that you actually can get back on the water more.
Yeah, I mean, we've already started doing that. We just hired this year, what was it, 3 months ago, something like that. We'd hired a new CEO. So I was originally the CEO. That was my call, actually. I said, look, this is too big now. We've got too many people. There's all sorts of laws and employment laws and regulations and HR and all these other things that come into a company of this sort of size. You can't ignore it. So we put Trent in place, and he's fantastic. And he comes from a much bigger organization that had lots and lots of people. And so we're bringing in the skill sets necessary where to help fill the gaps. And that's all about trying to get myself more time to focus on the CTO role, Chief Technology Officer, that's what it's called, so that, you know, I can do the thing that I was put on this planet to do, which is invent stuff. So, it's all good things, and there's lots of change, and this thing keeps going like a billion miles an hour. So it seems different every couple of months.
That is great. Still an adventure, even though you're super huge. I want to talk about your water sports story to end the podcast with. And we saw some amazing pictures of you behind a motorboat on a huge board. Then the part with your red swimming shorts, super cool as well.
Sorry.
They're super cool. So when you go on foil right now, what gear are you using? What sport are you even doing? Is it just like surfing on a break or downwinding? What do you do regularly?
Predominantly, if I get any time, I'm surf foiling on waves. We've got a lot of really good waves down where we live in Australia, plenty to choose from. The gear that I ride, Paul, very rarely will I ever foil the same thing twice. And this is going to sound really snobbish and a bit annoying to some people, but we get so much gear to test and to qualify and give feedback on. Very rarely do I ride the same board or the same mast or wing combination more than maybe twice. Which is fun because you get to try lots of things, but it can be a little bit annoying too, because you never get to like super dial into something. And like when you think about it, when you're working with, you know, I don't know what it is now, something like 14 different brands, they've all got wings, they've all got masts, and most of them have got boards, and they're always working on something new, and they're always sending you stuff to test and give feedback. And it might be for a photo shoot, a video shoot. It might be purely for testing. It might be for qualifying material. It might be for qualifying testing, fitment. Could be anything. There's just so much gear. Like this room is, there's some other rooms over there full of stuff. So yeah, I'm always on something different, which is fun. Like, don't get me wrong, that's a perk of the job to be able to try all the new stuff, but you don't ever get a chance to like fully lock into a setup, which I know people do, and they get really dialed in and they can push it, which is really good. But at the moment I'm riding, I've been on the Armstrong new integrated carbon mast and trying a whole bunch of different wings. The Code integrated carbon mast, trying some of their new wings out as well. On the North integrated carbon stuff as well, a bunch of different boards, trench boards, normal boards. There's stuff here in boxes that haven't even been opened yet. I'd love to get in the water more, but fortunately I've got a fantastic group of testers globally that I send a lot of stuff out to for them to do lots and lots of water time. So I can get hundreds of collated hours of riding test time done in, you know, days by sending stuff out to a series of global test riders around the world. And they can substitute and feedback to me a lot of the feedback. Break stuff, test stuff, improve stuff, whatever, that I just physically couldn't do. Like, I could be in the water all week and still not get as much testing done as these guys.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. When was the last time, or has there even been a time, like in the last 5 years, that you foiled without foil drive?
Don't think so. I'm trying to think. No, I don't think so. I'm trying to think. The only time I would have done that we did a couple of tow sessions. Few years ago we did some jet ski towing, but ever since Gen 2 came out, no one's tow skied the waves ever since. Everyone who foiled those bigger waves, that's called Shark Alley, when it really jacks up, it's quite, you know, it's decent size. It's like ocean swell that's moving at 30 k's, 35 k's an hour, and it then hits a bank and it's you can get some pretty decent waves. That's pretty much where everyone used to tow foil. But I haven't seen a single person do tow skiing, tow foiling since, because everyone just goes out in their Gen 2s and catches the waves independently. Tow foiling's fun, but there's so much organization. Got to get there at the right time. And then you got to launch at a ramp and get the ropes and the sleds and multiple people. In Australia, you have to have an observer to legally do it. So one person's not foiling, one person's driving, one person's observing. So two people aren't foiling, And then the third person gets to do the foiling. But as you would know, wind changes, condition changes, and everyone wants to be on foil. And so obviously, now everyone just foils at the same time.
How do you look at other products like the tow boogie, for example?
I think tow boogie's it's a cool idea. Props to anyone that's done it. I think the Takuma one was ridiculous without being too blunt. It's so big and heavy. You had to have like a trailer almost to move it. And I think that's why it just didn't work. There's an Aussie guy that's making it and then like an inflatable tow boogie. The name is escaping me, but that looks cool. I think that's a much better attempt at doing the tow boogie. I personally don't use them. I have no need, clearly. I've got access to all the foil drives I could ever need, but I don't quite like the idea of having to control a different thing. I can totally see the concept, whip yourself into a wave and ride a normal board and then drive it over to yourself and pull yourself back out again, but I think the amount of waves and breaks and zones where people aren't going to get really upset with that is probably limited, but I'm glad it's out there. It's definitely a different way of doing it, but it's not something that I want to get out of my car, grab my board, put a battery in, walk to the water, throw it in the water, foil as much as I possibly can until I run out of time and then leave. I don't want to have to set up all this extra stuff and wheel things to the beach and launch it. Yeah. And quite a few breaks that we foil at, there's so much white water. It's like 3, 4, 5 foot of white water. I don't even know how you'd get out because you have to duck dive under these waves. And we use the motor on the Gen 2 to motor under the water to pop back up. Like there's certain waves that before Gen 2, when we were on the bigger boards with the old assistances plus, we physically just couldn't get out if it was above a certain size because the white water was so big that you would just get picked up and just thrown back towards the beach because you couldn't physically get over this white water and you couldn't duck dive these boards, these bigger boards, and then the foil would get caught. But then when we got Gen 2, we all started riding smaller prone boards. We could literally duck dive anything. So then those waves and those locations just unlocked and we're the only people out there on foils. Yeah, I don't know how I got onto that subject, but yeah, boogies are cool. It's not something that I personally use, but they're cool.
That's not a direct competitor, but now some direct competitors start showing up. How does that make you feel seeing that other products copy so much from you or of you and you did all the hard work to invent like the whole thing?
It is a bit frustrating, but copying, some people say, is the greatest flattery. I don't know. That's a throwaway line. But look, it is a bit annoying, but it's going to happen. What are you going to do? People copy it because it is a good idea. I think where they go wrong and the customers that buy these things find out the hard way is that the company and the people behind someone that's just blatantly copying everything you do generally doesn't have the same morals or setup or structure or intent. I think that's pretty similar for whatever industry you're looking at, really. I'm human. It's a bit frustrating, but I don't really care that much. I just care about trying to make the best product that we possibly can. People that copy you always tend to be a bit behind the eight ball anyway. But it's a big enough world. It's going to happen. There's certain things that I wish people would go and do their own thing, but what are you going to do? It's a frustrating thing sometimes, but really I don't care that much. Like, all we can do is just make the best company and product that we can and focus on that. And people are going to copy it anyway. And I don't think it matters what industry you're in, unless it's heavily protected with IP and patents and all that sort of stuff, which we do have our own. And we've got some that will probably be utilized at some point, but I don't know. It's a big enough world. I'm not a person that worries about lack. I'm more worried about just getting the stuff out the door.
So that's good. You don't have too much time to think about other stuff as well. Well, Paul, we have to wrap it up here because I have to wake up my kids. They have to be ready for school. Thank you very much for taking your time. Is there anything you just want to tell the world? Maybe just a quick little word about Fusion.
Look, I think if you can get a chance to ride it, go and have a try. I'm getting a lot of feedback from people that thought initially, oh, it's going to be too heavy and that sort of stuff. I'm like, I wouldn't release it if it didn't feel good, because I'm the one that wants to ride it the most. And it's so far, most people are coming back and say, I actually can barely even feel the difference in mass, but I can certainly feel the difference in runtime and power. But I don't, if people buy them or not, I don't particularly care. There's a Slim, there's a Max, there's a Fusion, there's something for everyone. And I hope with those three offerings, we've got enough of a spread that that people can find what they want. But Fusion is a direct result of people just saying, I want more of the fun stuff. I want more runtime and power. So whilst we still live in the realms of real world physics, there was no other way of doing that other than add battery capacity and beef up the electronics. So that's what we did. But I love it. I think the one thing people need to remember is, and I was having a discussion only last night with someone who was testing it. I said, yeah, okay, so it might be roughly 2 kilos heavier. But what people aren't factoring into the equation is if you use the bigger unit and you're trying to push your equipment set up to the limit, that bigger unit can genuinely allow you to use a smaller board and smaller wings. So when you do the true math, which is one of my things, I like math. If you look at the total of equation, if you've added 2 kilos here, but then you're using a board that's 500 grams lighter and a wing set that's 500 grams lighter, and then you put it all together, you're actually only 1 kilo heavier. The total delta is only one. But then the swing weight equation is even more complicated, because now you're using a smaller board and a smaller, more nimble wing. The whole setup feels more agile and alive anyway. So it's not just that headline number of mass. It's the setup, the whole setup. And you would think it's obvious, but I've had numerous conversations with people who are like, oh, I don't know. I'm like, wait a minute. Look at your setup. You're on an 8 foot long board with a paddle. That paddle counts. So you take that whole setup and then go and ride a 4 foot, 10, 30 liter prone board with a much smaller wing, that you couldn't have a more different setup. And there's nothing against the long board and the paddle and the big wing, nothing against it at all, but you got to factor it all in if you're going to be assessing it for what it is. And it's kind of interesting in those conversations. Oh, yeah, good point. The swing weight of an 8 foot long board, believe me, is a lot more than a 4 foot eight prone board. And then they go and try it and they're like, oh, this is sick. How much fun. So, I don't know. As Rob Pura says, don't tell me, show me. I think that's a good line. It's like,
all right,
go and do
that's
it.
Perfect.
And tell me after you've tried it, I suppose.
Perfect words to finish up the podcast. Thank you very much, Paul, for taking your time and developing these products. Really helped me a lot, and I will continue using them. Thank you so much, and have a good afternoon, Matt.
Good luck with the little monkey. I'm off to see my daughter's Christmas carols.
Nice. All right. Good. Have a good one. Thank you.
Bye.